This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening. This is Rock Cash, your host this week on The People Speak. The People Speak invites audience participation. You can listen in by phone calling 805-399-1000. Access code 769608 pound when prompted. Or if you have a smartphone or a computer, you can go to bbsradio.com, navigate to station 2, and click on the listen icon. You can also participate during our show with a call-in question for our guests, toll-free USA and Canada. 888-429-5471. Tonight, our guest is Charles Shaw, filmmaker, Exile Nation. Charles has been videotaping law enforcement and the injustices carried out by our police officers in the performance of their duties and exposing the militarization of our police forces throughout the United States. But this is also a worldly situation being imposed on all countries. Charles is here to tell us why. Charles, can you give us a brief summary on your adventures?
No, sure. Where do you want me to start? I can go all the way back to when I popped out of my mother's womb, if you'd like. I'm an author and an activist and a filmmaker and an event producer. And I have kind of a strange history. Most of this ended up in a book I wrote called Exile Nation, Drugs, Prisons, Politics, and Spirituality. And it kind of charts my life drug addict, drug war reformer, and then ultimately a drug war prisoner. And it was those experiences in my early life that led me into activism in my 30s. And I got deeply involved in, you know, the anti-war and anti-globalization movements, and I got involved at the Green Party and a lot of progressive causes, and ended up in prison in 2005. And then since then, in the kind of 7 or 8 years since I've been out of prison, I've been really focusing on media and social justice and cultural revolution issues. So I've been focusing a lot on, you know, our economic system, but also on police brutality and on the growth of the national security and police state and a lot of the changing trends in demographics and politics and everything. I try to keep my foot in pretty much every relevant issue. I also have a kind of a other life as a event producer in alternative festivals and around the world, actually. So I wear many hats.
Why were you imprisoned? You know, can you please clarify to us the reasons that they were putting you in jail?
Sure. The short answer is nonviolent drug possession. I was caught with approximately 11 pills of MDMA. The bigger story involves a long history as a drug addict, two prior felony convictions, and a whole complex situation with the Chicago Police Department while I was an activist, that ultimately was what got me tripped up and sent away.
I see. So mostly because of your activism is the reason why they decided to press charges against you for other...
Well, it was certainly the reason why I was sent to prison without any hope of negotiation or any type of, you know, clemency. And all of that's in Exile Nation, too. It was definitely a politically motivated prosecution, but the arrest itself was, you know, mostly my fault. I kind of made a pretty stupid choice back then and paid for it dearly.
Okay. What influenced your activism to go out and, you know, go against the police force? Where was any brutality used against you? Or
absolutely. In fact, that's why I got in this whole situation with the police in Chicago that got me sent to prison. I was stopped illegally late at night on the night of April 30th, 2004 in Chicago, and four tactical unit police officers, which are these kind of plainclothes, you know, drug and gang cops, usually wear the bulletproof vests and the big Glocks on their side and the blue jeans. They kind of surrounded my car and ordered me out of it and told me they were going to search it. And I hadn't done anything wrong, and they were just intimidating me. So I refused to let them. And they dragged me out of the car and started searching the car. And in the trunk, they came across a number of flyers from meetings that I used to attend weekly in Chicago for the Chicago Coalition on War and Racism. And one of the member groups of this coalition was a group that was bringing a federal case against police in the same precinct and a neighboring precinct for all of these violations against young Latinos. They had put a whole bunch of these kids in prison for crimes they didn't commit, and, you know, murders and attempted murders and, you know, homicides and, you know, armed robberies and all this stuff they didn't have, you know, they had open cases for. They just kind of picked on a bunch of Mexican and Puerto Rican kids and put them in prison for it. One of the kids' mothers found an eyewitness to the actual murder that her son was convicted for. And this eyewitness went on the record, and she announced that she was going to launch a federal civil rights case against the Chicago Police Department for all of this. So they find the flyer from this group in my car and immediately assume that I'm a member of this group and decide to kind of send a message through me. So they beat me up, put a fake case on me, locked me up, and for about a year I had to fight this, you know, DUI, resisting arrest, assaulting a police officer charge.
And you weren't drunk? And
I wasn't drunk. I didn't assault the police officers. I mean, you know, all of this ends up being like, what ended up happening with the police is they could have just kind of said in the police report, the guy was drunk and belligerent. And given my past record, and given that there hadn't been that many years since I had been in trouble, odds are the judge would have probably believed the police. But these guys aren't rocket scientists in Chicago. And for some reason, they decided to embellish the report. So they embellished the report by saying that I, you know, was too drunk to stand, and then I kind of pulled away in my car after I had been taken out of the car, and they had all these kind of factual inconsistencies. But the funny stuff was when they said that I had started spouting all of these kind of neo-Nazi, Aryan Nation, far right-wing slogans about, you know, having the police and the judges killed. Now, this probably sounds very confusing, but at the time in Chicago, it was all a very relevant issue in the news because there was a very famous white supremacist on trial, a guy named Matt Hale. And this is a guy who wanted to be a lawyer, but the state of Illinois denied him a law license in the late 90s because he was a white supremacist and he preached all of this racial hatred. And when he was denied a law license, one of his followers went a little crazy and went on a shooting rampage and killed, I believe, 9 people in the Chicago area. And they were all racial minorities. And eventually this guy, Matt Hale, got arrested. He got himself involved in a federal case. Actually, he wasn't arrested. He was in a federal trademark case. And what he did was he hired his bodyguard, who happened to be an undercover FBI informant, to kill the judge in the case. And the media, just the day before the police beat me up, had announced that this had happened, that this guy had tried to kill his judge. The white supremacist hires bodyguard to kill judge. So these police, in all of their infinite wisdom, think that if they put on the police report that I'm shouting these drunken slogans supporting this, you know, hate-filled white supremacist that tried to have his judge killed, that no judge would give me a fair shake. What they didn't know about me was that I existed on the kind of far opposite end of the political spectrum, and I was able to prove it. So the story takes a very dark turn, though, because I left Chicago a month later when the police stormed the apartment of the woman I told you about, who was the mother of the falsely imprisoned kid. And this was the woman that was launching this federal civil rights case. Police stormed her apartment, hauled her away to jail, and she died in police custody. So this scared me just a little bit, and I left town for almost a year and went to San Francisco. And I had to eventually come back and fight the case. And when I did, I was able to prove that the police were lying. And I brought character witnesses and proof of my political affiliations. And the police got caught lying over and over and over again. And ultimately, the door was open for me to file my own civil rights case. And the police in Chicago were, you know, committed to making sure that that wasn't going to happen. So, you know, I was followed and watched and monitored for a few weeks, and then eventually they got me. And that's how I ended up in prison.
Wow. And how long did you stay in prison?
I got a year sentence, but I served less than half of it inside the prison. And then I served another year on parole.
Wow.
Which is no fun, I can tell you.
That goes to show you what the police departments can do, and we, the people, really don't have any recourse in anything that they do, because, you know, they're agents of the corporation, and they're to be believed before we are.
Yeah, and this is business as usual, particularly in all of the big metropolitan centers, and particularly any place with, you know, racial diversity. This is the way the police operate. And, you know, I was really surprised back in the mid-90s when I got in trouble, you know, when I had a drug addiction. I found that not only were the police completely, you know, discompassionate to anybody that was dealing with an addiction or any type of, you know, trauma or something, you know, that they weren't violent people. They weren't, you know, hurting others. They weren't necessarily causing crimes, except they're just using drugs. But the attitude of the police was that they were all the lowest form of life on the planet. And so when people really needed help, instead what they got was sent to prison. And when I really needed help, I got in trouble the first time. They lied to me. They lied to my family. They did pretty much every dirty trick you can imagine to get me the highest possible conviction that I could get. And that's when my eyes were first open to it. And then over the years, I just saw, you know, incident after incident that showed me that it was just a systemic pattern of corruption and brutality. And that's really the way that the police are. You know, it's hard to convince somebody who lives in a small homogenous community that doesn't have these issues that the police are like this, because, you know, most people know their policemen that way, or, you know, they've never seen anything like this. But, you know, almost all minorities, and certainly anybody who's, you know, got a conviction record, or anybody who lives outside of the mainstream culture, even if, you know, you're an artist or you like to go to festivals or anything like that, you're going to run into the police, and you're going to run into the darker side of them. And since the 9/11 era happened, you know, the post 9/11 era, and all of the legislation and all the permissiveness that's been given to the police and law enforcement to do whatever they want, well, now it's just really starting to get out of hand. Now we really do, you know, like the video tried to show, we're at the point where we have an epidemic with it.
Well, that's part of the process of militarization of the police and the prison planet. Your video, were you a part of the Occupy group also? Is that a part of one of the many things that you've done?
No. And I will say that although I supported in spirit the Occupy movement, and certainly there was no question of supporting them when they were getting wiped out, you know, when the coordinated order came from the White House to clear all of the encampments, you know, then there was solidarity for all. But I should say that I long before that realized that it was foolish to go into the street like that. And I learned this, you know, protesting the Bush administration and the Iraq war and dealing with the first few years after 9/11 and how that changed the security apparatus in the country. So trying to lead marches and demonstrations pretty much in anything after the Seattle 99 era, you know, it wasn't even 9/11 so much as it was after the battle in Seattle. It became too dangerous and too futile to try to go into the street with small numbers of people. And so when Occupy happened, I thought it was a wonderful symbolic gesture, but ultimately it was destined to collapse. And I'm grateful, and I put that in quotes, for Occupy for one reason, and I think it's because it finally showed the public that there really was this immense police state apparatus in place. And that it would be turned on its own citizens for something nonviolent like Occupy, that they were fair game, that anybody was fair game. And I'm pretty sure that that's what they wanted everyone to believe. I'm sure they really wanted to communicate that they weren't going to take any funny business in this era of terrorism and all of that.
Awesome. One of our viewers, or our listeners actually, Samantha from Chicago, wants to know, Charles, do you feel if what happened to you would happen now to all people, that you can record the video, would it be safer if you do so?
Okay, well, I want to tell Samantha in particular, Illinois is very dangerous, and it's one of the most stringent states when it comes to filming police activity. There recently was somebody that was facing 15 years in prison for trying to film a police officer. And I think that's the penalty. It varies state by state. But there is a higher obligation at some point. And I know that at least one of the people in jail in Illinois for this was willing to go to jail for it, given how wrong the law was that says you can get 15 years for filming police activity. But the thing is, you know, now cameras are our weapons. And the very same technology that the surveillance state is using on us is what we actually have to use to hold them accountable. I mean, we can't fight them. It's ridiculous to even talk about it. We are completely outnumbered, outmanned, and outgunned when it comes to weaponry. I mean, we outnumber them in raw numbers, but it's just insanity to even think about that. I mean, ultimately, we have to be smart. And so I think being smart is knowing the laws where you are, you know, particularly if you're going to go and try to film something in Illinois, know that you can be in serious trouble. So I think they say that with a police encounter in Illinois, you can film the audio, but you can't film the video. Okay. I think that there's a kind of a difference when you're talking about a special security zone. And I have footage from, you know, the G8 summit in Chicago from a couple of years ago. It's all, you know, full video and audio. But you know, it's all what you do with it. Like if they wanted to grab that person, they would. Okay. Anyway, that's a long winded answer just to say that, yes, I really do believe that this is, a responsibility for everyone now. And I recommend checking out a website called photographyisnotacrime.com and a guy named Carlos Miller, who's based out of Miami. And he's kind of like, he's been at the forefront of this whole, you know, photography is not a crime and use your camera for police accountability. And he recently went up against the Boston Police Department, who tried to put him in jail for holding him accountable. And he had to raise an emergency $3,000 or $4,000. He did it through Facebook and Indiegogo and in a matter of minutes. And it really showed the power of this technology and how we can use it to thwart what they try to do to us. So I hope that answers your question.
Well, she's got a couple more for you.
Awesome. That's my kind of friend.
All right. She also wants to know, with the longtime notorious reputation and the corruption of the Chicago police, do you feel that Gary McCarthy of New York City made a difference since he was out of the payoff and the Chicago mafia circle?
I have to admit that I am not sure who Gary McCarthy is. So I apologize.
He was the chief of police, I guess.
In New York or in Chicago? Not in Chicago.
I don't know, to be honest with you. And then she's got another one. The U.S.
Okay.
Okay. She's saying that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against Illinois prosecutors seeking to enforce that law that banned people from filming police while they were at work. The law, which the justices agreed and went against citizens, the rights to free speech, carried a maximum penalty of 15 years in prison. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, it's totally crazy. And it says something, too, when they got to put that kind of a penalty on an activity as, you know, seemingly benign as a camera, you know that there's a reason for it. Yeah.
Yep. Let's get to some other guests here on a radio show. Andrew in Washington wants to know, is it true that the Federal Reserve private police force is in fact private and it's growing exponentially growing?
Go ahead. I am not aware of any private police force that the Federal Reserve owns, nor that it is expanding.
Okay, and another one, Phil in Ohio wants to know, what is your understanding of false flag terrorism, and is it used to push through legislation like the Patriot Act, the NDAA, and do you think 9/11 was an inside job?
I have a feeling like I'm being tested instead of a question being put forward.
Well,
yeah, I know what all of those are. And,
okay.
You know, you got to be kind of either willfully blind or suffering a head injury to buy the official story on 9/11. I think that's a pretty easy one.
Okay, and we have Andrew again in Washington. He wants to know what your opinion is of the warrantless, suspicionless citizenship checkpoints located up to 50 miles inland all over, routinely conducted by the U.S. Border Patrol.
Awesome. Good question, and something that I'm really familiar with. And just to politely correct the brother, it's 100 miles now. It's not even 50 miles. So it means that whole states like Delaware and Rhode Island don't have any constitutional protections at all, if you think about it, right? So I am in the process of releasing a feature-length documentary called Exile Nation, The Plastic People. And I'm about to go to Los Angeles tomorrow to have a premiere screening of it. And we hope to have it out on Netflix and Amazon and stuff by the end of the year. And this is a film, this is a documentary I did about the mass deportation of millions of Mexican Americans. And it's set largely in Tijuana, just across the border. And so basically what ended up happening was in the post 9/11 era, they've gradually slammed the border shut. And I think they did this for, you know, for entirely different reasons than they proclaimed. And obviously, it had nothing to do with terrorism and had almost everything to do with the economic changes and a serious downgrading of America's importance in the economic system, the global economic pie. Globalization was seeking balance, and the rise of Asia and Brazil and Iran and Venezuela, other economies, is taking huge chunks of the American pie. And you know, we had this legal agreement with Mexico, but we couldn't honor it anymore. And we were going to start throwing people out by the millions. So we had to have some kind of excuse. And 9/11 was that excuse. So I've seen the worst of what's happened with this, customs border patrol situation. I've been down at the border. I spent 2 years down there filming this documentary. I've seen people beaten to death, run over by the police, set on fire, shot, you know, run into traffic. I mean, many of these things make it into the documentary. And on the other side of the border, it's become, you know, another kind of what we call mission creep, where, you know, slowly the powers of various agencies creep larger and larger and larger. And so they're slowly expanding inward. And they use the Mexican drug trade primarily as the reason for this. Now, without getting too deep into it, you know, the situation with Mexico isn't necessarily what they're telling us. It's not necessarily that we're being besieged by Mexican cartels, but maybe, you know, there's something like a huge demand coming from the United States. And there's also this whole weird Meridia initiative thing where we sent billions of dollars in guns to kind of help them with their war. And it turns out that those guns are actually being used to foment so much of the violence that we're then passing all of these laws against and expanding the powers of the government. So you see, it's like this Ouroboros that's just, you know, snake eating its tail. And, you know, you can't have one without the other.
Well, it's the snake eating our tail.
Yeah, well, that too.
Michelle in Oregon wants to know if you have any advice for the ordinary citizen that is being stopped and questioned.
Yes. My first piece of advice is to be exceedingly polite. Be exceedingly polite. Keep your hands visible. Make no fast movements. Don't get angry. Don't assert your rights or what's right or wrong. Simply go along with the encounter. There's three levels of police encounters out there. You know, there's a green level, a yellow level, and a red level. And a green level is kind of conversation, and it's all basically consensual. And a yellow is investigative detention. That's when they got to put you in the car or put the cuffs on you to make sure that you didn't do something else. And that's usually after they have probable cause. And then the third is you're being arrested for an offense. So a DUI checkpoint is perfectly legal because they're simply leaning in to see if they detect alcohol on your breath or in the car. And that's more than enough probable cause. And that's an imminent public danger because drunk people on the road are dangerous, period. Right? And that's something society agrees with. Now, drug checkpoints, on the other hand, are constitutionally illegal. That means that if you see a drug point up ahead, do not slow down, do not panic, do not pull off the road, because what they are looking for is, quote, suspicious activity. So it's, you come up to one of these so-called drug checkpoints, and if you want to leave or get off the road, then you're obviously suspicious to them. They'll obviously pursue you and then question you further. When you get to the drug checkpoint, you simply, answer their questions politely. And if they ask you to get out of your car or search it, you ask them, is this a request or is this an order? If they say it's an order, ask them if they could explain to you the probable cause, at which point most police officers will probably let you go and or start hassling you and saying, hey, what are you, a smart guy? What do you know about the law? What are you hiding something? And this is a tactic they use too. It's like basically a computer program that the police use. They're taught a few specific tricks, you know, and one of them is to always be suspicious and to press really hard anytime anyone resists against you, because, quote, they're always hiding something. And this is the kind of mentality that they're programmed with. And they're programmed to consider everyone potentially dangerous and hiding something. So everyone's a potential perp, right? everything needs to either be clarified as a request or an order. If you are given an order to get out of your car, you have to ask them what the probable cause is. But in my case, you know, and depending on where you are, like in Chicago, that may never matter. I just got dragged out by my neck. And many police will do that to you. So you have to be prepared for different types of reactions depending on what part of the country you're in and what race you are and what gender you are and what age you are and what kind of car you're driving and all kinds of things. I mean, all of these things relate to how you get treated by police.
Great. Just before we go to break, I got a quick question, and Angela somewhere in the U.S. wants to know if you're a part of Cop Watch.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, great. With that being said, we'll go to our break. You're listening live to the BBC Radio Network with the People Speak and our guest, Charles Shaw. We'll be right back.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, Pal Talk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 Pal Talk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining Pal Talk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive. But there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to VBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please. Give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back. This is your host, Rock Cash, back with my guest, Charles Shaw, here on the BBS Radio Network and our awesome engineer, Don Newsom. Welcome to the People Speak. Charles, thanks for coming back.
My pleasure.
You know, it's really going crazy out there. And I've got a ton of questions. I haven't had so many questions about any topic on the show in a long time.
Excellent.
Rob in California wants to know, where in California is the screening of your film Exile Nation, Plastic People?
It's going to be at the Big Arts Lab in downtown Los Angeles. And if anyone's interested in attending in the LA area, they can send me an email at cshaw@exilenation.org. And we can let them know the details.
Great. And Cheryl in Pennsylvania wants to know, what do you think the end goal of the people pushing for the militarization of police forces throughout our society?
I think it's pretty clear to me, and I'm glad that you brought up that question, because this relates to a new short film that I'm going to have hit the internet in probably about a week or two, and it's part of a new short film series we're doing called Unveiled, I'm partnering up with a radio show called Lifting the Veil. And so anyway, it's called Revolution X. And what it does is it takes us back to 1999 when the WTO protests erupted in Seattle. And that was a very unexpected protest. I don't think anyone in the power structure really suspected that that big a turnout and that big an organized presence across so many sectors of society would turn out the way it did. And then it turned into a total debacle, and largely by poor decision making by Norm Stamper, who was then the police chief. Now he's a he's a famous hero of the left because he's an anti-drug war crusader. But at the time, he was the one making the calls to clamp down on the movement. They had agent provocateurs that had infiltrated into all of the groups, and they started a bunch of violence, and then it turned into absolute chaos, and it sparked a global revolution. And the same thing happened shortly thereafter in Washington, D.C. at the World Bank IMF protests, and then almost a year later at the G8 summit in Genoa. And they were all chaos, bedlam, you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, violently protesting these policies. And this really scared them, particularly after Genoa, because, I mean, it was carnage in Italy that year. And, 9/11 just, you know, conveniently happened a couple of months later. And that was everything that they needed to shut down the movement. And they did. Right after 9/11, suddenly you got the security zones, you know. So now you can't get within 4 miles of the place. So, you know, what good is a protest if you're 4 miles away? You know, this 9/11 was all they needed to change the system. And so that was the first part of it. They needed legal cover, pretext in order to change the laws, change the culture, and militarize the police. But why are they doing it? Well, they're doing it. Look around the world. I mean, what do you see? When you see riot cops, what do you see? You see a society that is generally poor or in a very fast downward spiral economically. And when people lose their livelihoods, they lose their life savings, they lose their homes, their banks collapse, they freak out. They riot. They panic. They rise up. They demand change. They get out in the streets in a positive way. They get out in the streets in a negative way. And there are 7-odd billion people on the planet now, and it's growing. And that utterly terrifies them. The amount, the sheer number of people, of us, terrifies them. So they need that apparatus to keep us down as our standard of living spirals down the toilet bowl.
Right, Paul. That would be one of the main reasons we have all the chemtrails and all of the crap that they've been feeding us and spraying over us and everything else in an aspect to reduce the population.
Well, yeah,
because
I mean,
they fear a massive population.
Yeah, the population plans and all of that, you know, go back to the post-war era when, you know, the white post-colonial power structure was looking at, you know, the rise of, you know, billions of Asians and Arabs and Africans and Latinos and essentially overrunning what was left of the, you know, white colonial power structure that had created the world order and that still ran it, you know. And I think they're still very concerned with that, you know. And I think that that's why, you know, you see every effort being done to decimate, you know, Africa and the Arab world and much of Latin and Asian countries. So, yeah, they're very concerned about that. And rightfully, they should be, because I think we're in the final kind of days of, you know, white colonialism. It was bad enough. I don't think it needs to carry on much longer.
No, I'm in agreement with you on that. Trenton, Kentucky wants to know what it was about 1994 that set the whole militarization of the local police forces in the U.S.
Basically, what happened was that this new president's in power and the Cold War is over and there's no real reason to keep this, you know, $200-300 billion a year military apparatus. I mean, there's no enemy. And so you know, they stumbled around in the 90s looking for something to do with this military, but there was still all of this money that still could be made in the military economy. And so the LA riots happened in 1992, and there was a, you know, real palpable fear of more urban uprisings happening again, having another period like the 1965 to 1969 period, when there was something like, you know, 130 major urban riots or something like that. And that changed the face of the country forever. I mean, the suburbs exist largely because of those 60s riots, you know, particularly the exurbs and the far-flung white suburbs. It's all about getting as far away from the city as possible. So anyway, getting back to 94, you know, there's all of this military gear laying around, and there's, you know, a crack epidemic, and there's gang warfare epidemic in the inner cities. And so, you know, for Clinton, who needed to curry favor with the conservatives and look like he was tough on crime and fulfill his campaign promises, he just, you know, says, okay, hey, how'd you guys like all these guns? How'd you like tanks? We got, what do you want? Flashbangs? We got everything. And so this pipeline started from the federal government and the Pentagon into municipalities and metropolitan areas and into their police forces. And Clinton made a commitment to put, you know, 100,000 new federally funded police on the street, you know, in his first term, and I believe he did so. So that was when that line got broken between the military and domestic policing. And there's a long history that led up to it. I mean, there's, you know, the response to the 60s riots and the 60s movements, and then there's, you know, SWAT, which is, you know, there's a whole weird hanky story around the beginning of SWAT and the Symbionese Liberation Army, which, you know, kind of looks like it was a CIA operation. And so the whole thing kind of looks like it was a rigged game. The bottom line is war's big business in this country. It's the biggest business of them all. It's the way we've defined ourselves. We've founded our country in warfare, and we continue to evolve through warfare. And so the war economy is the most important. And this is just the easiest way. Just turn it on the public, you know?
Of course, it's big business for the IMF and the bankers. Because, of course, they're funding both sides and charging the citizenry interest on everything.
Oh, sure. But, I mean, don't take away the plain old power of, you know, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, GE, DuPont, all these companies involved in the war industry and every level of it. They, you know, they need to keep this machine going. You know, the Pentagon got really smart in the 50s. And they realized that if they broke down all of their military bases, expenditures, programs, and everything, and they put a little bit in all 50 states, and all the corporations found that if they put all of their manufacturing, you know, the defense corporations, they put a little bit of manufacturing in all these different states, then cutting the defense budget meant cutting jobs, and no congressman or senator would ever go and say, cut the defense budget, because that means putting their own people out of work. It was a brilliant strategy, and it works to this day.
Yeah, very, very brilliant. Sharon in Pennsylvania wants to know, what do you know about the geopolitical plans of people in the group PNAC or Project of a New American Century?
I think they're done. I think they did their thing, and they got what they wanted, and that's it. They were probably some of the dumbest and most dangerous ideologues that we've ever had in power, but they succeeded. They got their new Pearl Harbor. They got the massive change in the military that they wanted. They got all the money they wanted. They got the cultural shift that they wanted. And, you know, the only expense was something that they don't even care about, which is that the public doesn't like them too much. They don't care. They're all rich.
Absolutely, they are. And my question to you is, what do you think of all the law changing that is going on and the Constitution being just put to the side and they're just doing what they want to do and disregarding the Constitution and the Bill of Rights.
I think it's something that you need to be concerned about. I think it's something we're not talking about enough. And I think that we're at almost a breaking point, if not at a breaking point. Everything that we understand to be the fundamental basis of our rights and freedoms for this country has been completely shredded in the last 15 years. You know, and we just stood by and let it happen. I mean, I haven't seen nary a person stand up and scream about the NDAA. You know, you might post a little bit on Facebook, gosh, this really stinks. How could they do this to us? But nobody's really doing anything about it. And so they're going to keep doing exactly what they're doing because they open their window and they listen and they don't hear anything. You know why Nixon stopped doing what he was doing? In part, aside from the fact that he was psychotic and they had to stop him, is because he would open up the White House window every day and he would hear them chanting at the gates for his head every day for years. We don't do that stuff anymore. We got better things to do than care about, you know, where our country goes. And, you know, until we change that and start to realize that this is all like in our hands to change it, but we got to get out of our chair, get off the internet, get out together and start doing it, you know, then I just think that, you know.
Well,
we have no business complaining. I mean, honestly, like we really don't. Like we're basically asking for it if we're not doing anything to change it.
Well, I think that they have made the scenario for us to where we're going to be too busy in our lives to be able to look after what the government is doing. So they would be able to manipulate anything that they wanted to because we're really not paying attention. We might be watching the news, but what are we doing about it? And this is where I blame the citizenry for the most part because we have allowed them to do that.
Yeah. But, you know, the other thing is that some of this is just out of our control. I mean, you got to remember we're a country of 312 million people right now and growing. You know, we're not like, you know, England or Denmark or, you know, Sweden where they've got, you know, maybe 10 million people, maybe 20, 50 at the most. We're a huge, huge, multicultural conglomerate nation. And if you look at other nations our size, like Brazil, you look at Iran, you look at Egypt, you know, you look at Mexico, they're chaotic and there's no real middle class and there's just a gigantic underclass and they don't have any clue what's going on in the world. Most of their reality is on the block level and most of their security or enforcement is by criminal elements. And so that's where we're headed. We're getting too big to manage. I mean, India is in name a democracy, but, you know, I do a lot of traveling. I've been to a lot of these places, and I got to tell you, the rest of the world's a pretty chaotic place. And I think that the people who run the show aren't looking at us as any special. They're just saying, well, America's going to become another chaotic place.
Well, I don't think that they're looking at us becoming chaotic. I think they're looking at destroying us or destroying the nation.
Yes. Well, there are definitely people out there that got a beef with us and want to get rid of us for sure. I agree with you on that one.
Absolutely.
And rightfully so. You know, we've done some things that we have not exactly held ourselves accountable for.
Well, I think the finger is being pointed in the wrong direction. I think they're pointing the finger at these people and saying, well, they want to, you know, take us out. But the real people that want to take us out are the ones that are usually pointing the finger. You know, it's a great mass of deception. Michelle in Arizona wants to know if you have any views on the political party system. Does it serve the people or is it time for a revolution or what kind of a revolution?
Well, I would say that for the, you know, 50 million liberals and 50 million conservatives that vote Democrat and Republican, that's a third of the country and they'll say it works just fine for them. However, that's a third of the country, and it seems like two-thirds of the other the country doesn't vote, and that's a lot. And yeah, not all of them are of voting age, but still, that's a significant amount of people that aren't participating in the system. And so on that level, for all the people that aren't, for people like me that got involved, I was an official with the Green Party for a number of years until I realized the absolute complete futility of that, of trying to get a third party to do anything in this system. So you're only stuck with the two parties, and now what they are is essentially corporate vehicles. So do I think now that there's any reason for anyone to vote or to put any faith in anything besides their local systems? No. I think the states and I think the federal system is completely corrupt. And I think that it's broken. I think it's pretty obvious it's broken. I mean, Obama should have been like everyone's gigantic light bulb going off over their head when, you know, it was too good to be true. He promised all of this change, and of course we got none. We just got more of the same and worse. Most people woke up to that, but there's still people that are in complete denial, and they still think, well, you know, he's better than Newt Gingrich. Or, I mean, they're all the same. They're all the same.
Yeah, there's nothing different. They're all just as crooked, and they're all in collaboration with each other.
All of them. Ron Paul, too. All of them. You don't play in that game unless you're corrupt. It's impossible. You got to be in the game and in the system to play the game and to play the system. And
right, because
people like Paul are, you know, controlled opposition and all of these complex ways that they get people to look that way, look this way, run this way, look everywhere but where they should be looking.
I agree with you because look at Cynthia McKinney. You know, when she didn't play ball, they ousted her real quick.
Yes, they did. And what's funny about her is that they had to rig voting machines the first time to do it. And, you know, if it wasn't clear example, you know, in 2002, they passed the Help America Vote Act, which helped America voting, which helped America vote by stealing their votes in a touchscreen system, right? Two brothers, the Odell brothers, controlled 80% of the voting technology in this country during the Bush administration. They were avowed followers of the Republican Party, supporters of the Bush administration. They promised Bush that they would give him the 2004 election. The 2002 midterms is the first one where they have these voting, the touchscreen Diebold machines. And the entire frickin' country votes Republican. Gosh, big surprise. Even the all-black inner-city district of Atlanta, where Cynthia McKinney represents, they even voted for a white Republican in that district, too. And somehow nobody went, huh, wait a minute. This don't make no sense.
Well, what can we do?
Yeah, exactly. What can we do? Well, we should do something different is what we should do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, can you please give the people the information how they can watch more of your videos and also your email address again so they can contact you when you do your screening in California in case
they don't
show up?
So my book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, independent bookstores, pretty much anywhere. Exile Nation, Drugs, Prisons, Politics, and Spirituality. You can also find it and my films and my videos and a bunch of talks that I've given on my website at exilenation.org. And if you want to come and see the Plastic People in L.A., you can email me at cshaw, that's C-S-H-A-W, at exilenation.org.
Great. And that wraps up our show for this evening. Thank you very much for being our guest tonight, Charles. And I'd like to thank Don Newsom on the BBS Radio Network. This is The People Speak, and we are out. Have a good night.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief of us, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters, Yeah, this land is made for you and me.